Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Reminder that we have this week's Wonk Wars question up on our politics website. Each week on It's a Free Country, we take one of our planned on-air conversations and begin it online with a couple of policy wonks. This week we're asking, will financial reform drive jobs away from New York? This week's wonks are Greg David, formerly of Crane's New York Business, and Nomi Prinz, former manager at Goldman Sachs and author of the book It Takes a Pillage. Read their posts, join the conversation online, and tune in tomorrow to hear us discuss on air. Look for the Wonk Wars section at our new politics site. It's freecountry.org. Well, the great wars of the 20th century were won and lost in the Atlantic and Pacific theaters, and those regions held American attention for decades. Today, that attention has shifted mostly to the Middle East and the area around Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our next guest says that through all of this, we've forgotten the region that is about to challenge American global power, the Indian Ocean. That body of water is bounded in the north by the Indian subcontinent, in the west by Africa, and in the east by Indonesia, as well as the Sunda Islands and Australia. You may remember your grade school geography, or maybe not, but our next guest, Robert Kaplan, says that many Americans are barely aware of the Indian Ocean and its importance to the United States at all. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and now the author of a brand new book called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Robert Kaplan, welcome back to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be here, Brian.
We've gotten this far without major problems in the Indian Ocean, or so we think. So why should we pay attention to it now?
Because the Indian Ocean unites the problems of the Middle East with the challenge of the rise of China. The Indian Ocean encompasses the entire arc of Islam, from the Sahara Desert in the west to the Indonesian archipelago in the east. It's where the competition of the 21st century, what's going to frame the competition on the Eurasian supercontinent in the 21st century is going to be between India and China. What this book is about is it takes the reader into the geopolitical security climate through a travelogue after Iraq, after Afghanistan. What is the world that awaits us after these two wars? And what I'm saying is we've had two messy ground wars that have you know, caught our attention in the last decade. The future of military activity is going to be maritime.
Really? Maritime. And sure enough, you say the U.S. and China are shifting to a two-ocean navy, those two oceans being the Pacific and Indian. You write that China is rising militarily in a responsible manner and that the country is not necessarily America's adversary. So how might China's naval development impact American power?
The United States Navy has essentially owned the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean since World War II. They've been American lakes. Americans take no note of it because it's precisely because it's been a unipolar military climate in these two oceans. It's been very stable. But that is changing. We're seeing the size of the American Navy has gone down from 600 warships during the Reagan era to under 300 now and may go down to 250 ships. It's very gradual, inexorable. Meanwhile, the Chinese Navy is going to have more submarines than we have in a few years. China is rising on sea because it has the luxury. Its land borders are secure for the first time in many hundreds of years of Chinese history, and so it has the luxury to go to sea. We keep hearing about China's defense budget increasing by 10% every year. Most of that money is going into its navy. And China wants to dominate the first island chain in the Pacific, and it wants a series of, we'll call them coaling stations in the 21st century across the Indian Ocean that will box in India and is making Indians very nervous.
But if you conclude that China is rising militarily in a responsible manner and that it's not necessarily America's adversary, what's the implication for the United States?
The implication for the United States is this is not a dark scenario I'm painting. This is not a dark book at all. It ends on an optimistic note. It's very complex. What I'm saying is that the United States will remain the indispensable balancing power between India, China, and other powers in the Pacific. We've had a multipolar economic climate since the mid-1990s. We're entering a multipolar military climate, and multipolar military systems are inherently more unstable than unipolar ones. But again, this is all abstractions. What I do in the book is I take the reader on the ground from Oman to Burma to Pakistan to India to Indonesia to other places.
Take us to one of those places. Tell us a story.
Let me tell you a story about Oman, where the book opens up. Oman isn't much known about, but it has a great strategic location. It controls the Straits of Hormuz, which control the Persian Gulf. Oman has probably the most fascinating unknown Arab leader in the whole Middle East. His name is Sultan Qaboos, and he is unmarried. He composes classical music. He's in favor of women's rights and environmental rights. He's an absolute dictator and yet runs his country in a very benevolent style. He's hosted the U.S. Navy. He can argue the positions of the Israelis and Palestinians from both points of view, the Iranians and the Americans from both points of view. He's a perfect go-between between the United States and Iran, but rather than do that, he prefers, in the style of a Victorian gentleman, to remain obscure, as if getting attention in the media in any form is a sign of bad manners.
Why?
Because his country is at a very precarious position. It's only 3 million people. It's right across the Persian Gulf from Iran with its 74 million people. It's faced Iranian domination for hundreds of years. It's fearful of Saudi Arabia, of the instability of Yemen. The way the Sultan protects the Sultanate is by maintaining a very low-key style. Interesting, the Arabian Sea, which is half of the Indian Ocean, used to be called the Sea of Oman. In the 19th century, it was Oman that controlled many East African ports down to Kenya and Tanzania. It has a very rich history that I go into in the book.
Robert Kaplan, my guest on WNYC from The Atlantic Magazine, now the author of Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. By the way, Robert Kaplan has an event coming up related to the book. He'll be at the Barnes & Noble at 82nd Street and Broadway in Manhattan on Monday, November 1st at 7 p.m. So if you're interested in this, mark down that on your calendar, 7 o'clock Monday the 1st at the Barnes & Noble, 82nd and Broadway. The subtitle, as I just said, is The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. How do you define American power? Because we could take calls all day from people saying, well, our interest shouldn't be American power. Our interest should be right and wrong. America already has too much power.
Well, America is going to be more needed in the 21st century precisely because we're the only Asian power, and we are an Asian power because we have bases throughout the Western Pacific. We're the only Asian power that's outside Asia. That has no territorial aspirations in Asia. So we're trusted by the Indians. We're trusted by the Japanese. We're trusted by the Indonesians. We're trusted by the Australians. We're trusted by the Omanis. And they all want us as a hedging power against China or India, whatever the case may be. Some say it very publicly, like the South Koreans and the Indians. Others say it very quietly, like the Indonesians.
The Indonesians, you write very interestingly about them in the book, and you say as a Muslim society, they're so important to the United States. In what ways?
Yes. When we think of Muslims, we tend to think of Middle Eastern Muslims who are the products of deserts and all the extremities of thought that deserts supposedly give rise. But this book shows the seafaring cosmopolitan tradition of Islam, how the faith was carried by merchants on ships across the Indian Ocean to the South Seas and the Far East into tropical climates. And because the religion was proselytized by merchants, it developed a very soft cosmopolitan edge that became an overlay on the traditional Javanese cultures of Indonesia and the Malay Peninsula.
Is there an implication for U.S. national security there?
Yes, there is. We keep hearing that Muslims cannot adopt to democracy, but Indonesia has more Muslims than any country in the world, over 200 million, and yet it's been a very successful, moderate, low-key democracy for the past 12 years. We've been promoting India over the last three administrations, the Clinton administration, 8 years of President Bush, and the Obama administration. It's time for the United States to promote Indonesia as sort of a second India in the region, a second rising India.
We're just about out of time, but I just have to ask about the title. Monsoon, why the monsoon metaphor?
Yes. A monsoon in to American ears sounds like a storm. It sounds like something negative, cataclysmic. But in fact, the monsoon is a life giver. Without the monsoon, there's no agricultural cycle. The monsoon winds, the monsoon is a wind system. The winds in the Indian Ocean are utterly predictable because the monsoon switches 180 degrees like clockwork every 6 months. That makes sailing distances predictable, which means that the Indian Ocean did not have to wait for the age of steamships to unite it. So you see a common culture all the way from Africa 6,000 miles across into the South China Sea. You see Yemenis in Indonesia. You see Indonesians in Zanzibar off the coast of East Africa. This common culture is all a product of the monsoon winds.
Robert Kaplan from The Atlantic, author of Monsoon, the Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk about Islam some more in a minute with our next guest, Sam Harris, who argues that science can establish morality without belief in God. Stay with us.